Chapter 4. The Laboratory of Love. The Catastrophic Collapse. When the New York operating system suffered its catastrophic blue screen event in Dr. Hoffman's office, the gray sinusoidal wave of the psychiatrist's voice flattened into a straight, absolute horizontal line of silence. The sterile, 60 hertz hum of the clinic's fluorescent lights evaporated as if someone had pulled the main power cable on the universe. The heavy mahogany bookshelves, the leather upholstery, the ticking of the analog clock on the wall, all the physical data points of Manhattan, simply ceased to render in my brain. Time did not merely stop. It froze, bent, and collapsed inward upon itself like a paper accordion. I was undergoing a total system reboot, and the destination was the long spring of 1970, just before the milestone of my 5th birthday. The transition was a breathtaking, perfect sensory algorithm. The artificial recycled air of the Upper West Side, which usually smelled of old paper and suppressed neuroses, dissolved instantly. It was replaced by the crystalline chill of the high Atlas Mountains mixing perfectly with the warm breeze of the Moroccan plains. My senses were suddenly flooded with an intoxicating blend of blooming bitter orange blossoms and distant snowmelt, a scent anchored by the rich depth of ancient amber. It was the undeniable olfactory signature of home. The geography of the Atlas Lion. To the uninitiated foreign eye, particularly the deeply ignorant Western observer, our geography is often lazily painted as a monolithic, scorching desert wasteland. It is a profoundly flawed dataset. Yes, the Sahara exists in the extreme south, but Marrakesh is not Qatar, it is not the UAE. Morocco is the California of Africa. We possess two massive mountain ranges, the Rif and the Towering Atlas, and two sprawling coastlines. We are a land where you can ski down snow-covered peaks in the morning and walk through a lush, temperate valley in the afternoon. In March, the reality of the Moroccan spring was undeniable. The morning air was sharp, carrying the chill of the Atlas peaks that loomed on the horizon like a series of jagged, high-definition triangular equations. The algorithm of humility. To understand my operating system, you must understand the architecture of my origin. Marrakesh was a vital node in an ancient dynastic network including Fez, Meknes, and Rabat. From the outside, our home was a masterpiece of social camouflage, a blank, windowless wall and a completely average, unassuming wooden door. This was a deliberate architectural firewall. In the Medina, a majestic riad could share a party wall with a modest one-room dwelling, and from the alleyway, you would possess absolutely no visual data to distinguish them. Grandeur is strictly reserved for the private sanctuary. It is never paraded in the street to incite envy. You only understood the majesty of the house after you were invited to cross the threshold. Once you stepped inside and closed that heavy wood, the external world ceased to exist, the thermodynamics of sanctuary. I entered the waste Addar, the central patio and courtyard. To my developing hyper-analytical processor, the Riyadh was a marvel of passive thermodynamics, fed by a hidden system of Kataras, ancient gravity-fed underground channels moving snowmelt directly into the heart of the Medina. In the spring, the thermodynamics were flawless. The fountain maintained a perfect temperate equilibrium. The massive pie's walls possessed an immense thermal mass, absorbing the afternoon sun and radiating that heat inward during the plummeting night temperatures. The estate was divided into distinct wings, the guest wing, the kitchens, and the deeply guarded women's quarters. A space where I operated as a high-level silent infiltrator, the sacred geometry of the ancients. Every surface was a mathematical equation. The floors were covered in cool zellige tiles, physical manifestations of infinity. Master artisans chipped enameled clay into complex polygons, laying them out in fractally expanding star patterns. When human emotion became too chaotic, the math of the zellige never lied. Above the tiles were walls of plâtre sculpt, thick layers of lime-based stucco carved into bas-reliefs of sacred geometry. These surfaces acted as acoustic diffusers, softening the ambient sound into a tolerable hum. And overhead, the Atlas cedarwood ceilings. The Jefna, fit together flawlessly without a single metal fastener, a pure algorithm of tension and weight, painted with the hand-painted Zawaka motifs of the eight-pointed Khatam star, the matriarchal server. These afternoons were presided over by Nana, my father's mother. She was the central server for our community, hosting the gathering with the precision of a high court justice. The Wast Addar became a sanctuary of aesthetic order, filled with women from across the Derb who came to master the rabbity embroidery, while normal children engaged in the chaotic, unstructured throwing of balls against masonry walls, my mind required a more rigid order. During the mandatory siesta, a period of rest no child ever actually surrendered to, the others would invent whispered games or absorb the illogical fables of Yuha the trickster. I had no use for Yuha. He was a variable that changed values without a governing equation. I sought the absolute truth of geometry, the fluid dynamics of Attai. The fuel for this gatherings was the Attai ritual. The pourer would lift the heavy silver pot a full meter above the glasses, creating a perfect, unbroken laminar stream of amber liquid. This was mathematically necessary to aerate the water and create the thick crown of foam that signaled a perfect brew. We served three rounds, bitter as life, sweet as love, gentle as death. Alongside the tea were Griba almond cookies, whose surface cracks formed beautiful fractal patterns, and Amlu, a rich suspension of roasted almonds and honey. It was a sensory environment managed perfectly by matriarchal protocols, the encoded silk of the Almohads. The women arrived in cultural armor, garments dating back to the 12th century Almohad dynasty. Most wore the Takchita, a two-layered system featuring the Tatia base code and the Diafina outer dress. My eyes locked onto the Arkad, the silk buttons running down the center, a complex tension-based fastening system. I catalogued their regional coordinates. A neighbor from Fez wore the NTAA kaftan, heavy dark green velvet covered in scully gold thread embroidery. Another wore the crib, vibrant yellow brocade known as the one who ruins due to its astronomical cost. To me, she wasn't just wearing a dress, she was wearing a massive, calculated financial risk. My mother favored the Baja of Marrakesh, a stiff brocade originally designed for luxury home decor, providing a structured, geometric silhouette. To her left sat a cousin from the north, in a Tetuani velvet featuring the Kanjar embroidery. I found it mathematically fascinating to use a weapon of war as a decorative element of feminine luxury, the gathering of the matriarchal algorithms. In wave physics, harmony is a fragile state. In our Riyadh, the dissonant note usually arrived in the form of a neighbor whose social software had not been updated since the Middle Ages. I was late in speaking, having identified that most adult conversation was statistically redundant. However, my silence became a puzzle for visiting matriarchs. One guest, wrapped in an attention-seeking Rabati kaftan, declared, "He will speak soon, and then you won't be able to silence the flood." She then deployed the proverb, "May God protect you from the silent one when he finally speaks." I sat there, calculating the irony. They were praying for protection from a 5-year-old for the crime of not discussing whose daughter-in-law was the least efficient at making couscous. These words drove my mother to anguish. Yet she remained trapped by the rules of hospitality. A logical paradox where you must remain a gracious host while your guest dismantles your child's dignity. Nana, the CEO of the Riyadh, saw the system failure. She couldn't scold her guest, so she executed a silent override. She caught my mother's eye and gave a millimeter tilt of her chin, an emergency evacuation authorization. Go, the laboratory of love. My mother extracted me to her quarters and locked the iron-studded wooden door, shutting out the analog world. She would drop to her knees and hug me with grounding pressure. She knew I wasn't world. She would drop to her knees and hug me with grounding pressure. She knew I wasn't broken, I was just encrypted. In the absolute quiet, she asked me to perform the most complex task in the universe, authorizing the audio output for the basic building blocks of reality. "Ah, ooh, ye," she would whisper. I would analyze the request. I had the letters in my cache, but the hardware-to-software interface was the problem. Moving the vocal cords felt like trying to land a 747 on a postage stamp. When my hardware finally complied and produced a vowel that was 90% recognizable, her joy was a physical heat source. That locked room was the secret laboratory of love, the one place I could blue screen without a neighbor offering a proverb about it. The reboot. I was still there, safe in 1970, when a specific olfactory code reached me, the sharp bloom of vintage Chanel Antaeus, myrrh, and clary sage. Then a hand traced my jaw. My eyes flickered open. The red walls of Marrakesh and the Almohad silks vanished. I was curled on Dr. Hoffman's leather chair in a position that would have horrified my tailor. I was 33, but for 2 hours I had been the boy in the women's wing. Carmen Tardelli was hovering inches from my face. armored in a Hermes leather coat. "The session was 15 minutes, Adam," she whispered. "You've been under for 2. The session was 15 minutes, Adam," she whispered. "You've been under for 2 hours. Hoffman looks like he's seen a ghost. I called Stanley. He said you never came down. So I took a car. Nobody keeps the line in a cage for 2 hours without checking for a pulse." I sat up, manually overriding my posture to regain my imperial gravity. I think my system encountered a logical incompleteness paradox, first proposed by a man named Kurt Gödel. Carmen pulled back, her eyebrows knitting into a look of unadulterated skepticism. "A Hudel? And who the hell is Kurt Gödel?" "He was a mathematician, Carmen," I explained, my mind still half-anchored in the star patterns of the Riad. "He proved that," I explained, my mind still half-anchored in the star patterns of the Riad. "He proved that within any logical system, there are things that are true but can never be proven. He discovered the ultimate blue screen of the human mind. He eventually stopped eating because he became convinced that people were trying to poison him. He basically died of too much logic." Carmen stared at me for a poison him. "He basically died of too much logic." Carmen stared at me for a beat. Then she let out a short, sharp exhale, half laugh, half groan. "Great! So you're comparing yourself to a guy who starved to death because he was too smart for his own good," she countered. She kept her hand firmly on my shoulder. "Look, I don't care about your dead math friend Kurt. You weren't calibrating, Adam. You were gone. Total system failure. Come on, Hoffman is out and calibrating, Adam. You were gone. Total system failure. Come on. Hoffman is out in the hall looking like he's just seen the ghost of your Kurt Gödel and several other dead mathematicians. Let's get you to the car before he tries to charge us a nap surcharge on the bill." She reached out and smoothed my lapel, her eyes searching mine for the blue sparks of short-circuiting logic. For the first time, I didn't pull away. I just sat there, the little professor finally coming back to the room, realizing that while I might be an accident of biology, at least I had managed to acquire a highly efficient, fiercely loyal guardian.